You're listening to a 3CR podcast of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia.
Radio MMT respectfully acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land from which we are broadcasting, the Wurundjeri people, and we are broadcasting to the Kulin nations. Our focus is economics, that is, how stuff is produced and distributed. We recognise that for many tens of thousands of years, First Nations people's connection to country successfully embodied the world's oldest continuous economy, which was catastrophically disrupted by genocide and displacement. We acknowledge that we have much to learn to reshape our current extractive and exploitive system to achieve sustainable prosperity for everyone.
Radio MMT. Economics for the rest of us with Anne
and Kev.
Radio MMT.
Looking at the world through the lens of modern monetary theory.
Radio MMT.
Macroeconomics for a well-being economy.
Macroeconomics? Like, isn't that incredibly boring?
No, Kevin, it's incredibly interesting. It's all about who gets what and why.
Who gets what and why? Okay, I'm in.
Radio MMT at gmail.com.
Incredibly interesting macroeconomics for the rest of us.
Yes, you are on 3CR Community Radio. This is Radio MMT, and I am Anne, your host for the next hour as we meander our way through the macro economy. And I have been away on a really lovely break, and now it's Kev's turn to have a bit of fun. I think he's having way too much fun as we speak. But we are going to have our own version of fun in the studio today, because with me is Harry Rossen. Harry, welcome.
Thank you, Anne. Good to be here.
Good to have you here. So, you know, Harry, tonight might not have happened if the seating arrangements at the pub kept going the way they were, because you and I just somehow we ended up keeping on being down opposite ends of the table, and I hardly got a chance to speak with you.
Yeah, we somehow kept missing each other.
Yeah, so what we're talking about here are pub nights, so that's a regular thing now, and the pub night group, as Kev and I like to call it, we are sort of coalescing into a group called Public Money, Public Good, which kind of sums it up, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a good name.
So if people are in Melbourne and you would be interested in getting on down to the pub and having a chat, then it is every fourth Friday we try and do that. It's usually somewhere in the inner city in Collingwood or Fitzroy. And if you want to get alerted on where we're going to be meeting, you can sign up at publicmoneypublicgood.net. And I believe these events are even happening beyond Melbourne now. I'm not sure what's going on, but some of the other capital cities, I think, might be having their pub nights.
Yes, yeah. I think we've started having them in Canberra and Sydney. I'm not sure if the Canberra one's up and running or not, but I think we've had one or two.
There's a rumour. We'll start it. So, Harry, you are part of the international cohort who are studying with Modern Money Lab at the moment. And that's a course known as the Graduate Studies in the Economics of Sustainability. And later in the hour, I'm hoping to hear more about how you apply that kind of economics to the existential crises that we're all facing. Before we get into the heavy-hitting stuff, I am curious about what your personal MMT story is. And I do like to ask people this because coming to MMT, it's not an obvious thing to do because there is so much misinformation out there, not just about like MMT, but about the economics in general. So it's not an obvious path to tread. So, Harry, how did you get here?
It's something we all probably have that eureka moment at some point. For me, it was like, I think a lot of us who are progressives or into heterodox economics and things like that, you're looking at all the bad stuff, the things that are wrong with the world, the inequality and poverty, and most of us are disgusted by it and want to do something about it. So probably came from more of an emotional place for me, wanting to do something about that. And then I noticed, like, when you look on the TV or in the news or listening to politicians, it just seemed that any policy that kind of hurt people, like cutting welfare or something, was always couched as good for the economy. And the economy just seemed to be this nebulous kind of thing. And then And then if there was a good policy that's going to help people or help the environment, then progressive people would always seem to be on the back foot having to defend themselves why it was good for the economy.
Mm-hmm.
So it just seemed to be something that conservatives had this monopoly on. So I realised it's like this really powerful rhetorical weapon that they have that they can wield to make misanthropic policy or unpopular or not very nice policy sound like it's technical and it's a necessity and it's just this mechanical thing that has to happen.
So you had your doubts, obviously.
Yeah, you smell a bit of a rat, like, you know, this keeps working out to the advantage of the powerful and stuff. And then I probably went through the typical kind of pipeline of heterodox economics where you start off on your gateway drugs, your Naomi Klein and your Hajun Chang or something, and then before long you're smoking some Yanis Varoufakis and then you're always, there's that feeling of like something was still missing. Like these guys are always going on about debt and money, and I just, even reading Yanis Varoufakis's book when I was younger, he's talking about the Eurozone and debt and bonds and stuff, and I just, it was an insecurity, like at a weak point, you know, it's like a chink in the armor. It's like, I don't actually really understand that.
Mm-hmm.
So you dig into it, and then before long you stumble across the deficit myth and Stephanie Warren
Kelton,
and
who's
Bill.
One of the MMT economists.
Yes, yep, Warren Mosler, Bill Mitchell, Randy Ray, all the goats, the goats of the industry.
Yes.
Yeah.
So why did you stick with them rather than keep going off into some other direction?
Well, I mean, we're always learning and continuing to, it'd be a bad idea to just kind of put the deficit myth down and be like, all right, I know all the answers to the universe now. But it's definitely like, once you realize the implication of it, it's definitely the missing link, right? Like you can read and learn about all the other heterodox kind of fields, Marxism, post-Keynesianism, they're not mutually exclusive. That's the cool thing. Sometimes you see Marxists being like, oh, MMT, that's not us, which I think is silly. It's like, you should understand how government spending works. Like, otherwise it's just going to be a vulnerability for you.
I always think of it as MMT is not the only thing you need to know, but it's definitely a necessary thing to know.
100%, yeah. And we'll probably get into that later when we talk about degrowth and stuff.
Sure. Well, you know, speaking about all the misinformation that is out there, I was listening to a bit of mainstream media and I did find myself jumping up and down, yes, getting a bit infuriated. So I thought I would just share some of that infuriation. So here's a blip from the mainstream media.
Australia's debt is about to cross $1 trillion for the first time in history. This is big.
National debt is on track to surpass $1 trillion in the coming weeks as Jim Chalmers prepares to deliver his May budget.
For the very first time in Australia's history, Australia's debt will soon hit $1 trillion.
We learned today that the federal government's total borrowings figure is due to hit the $1 trillion mark.
Just close your eyes, I'll sing you this conspiracy lullaby.
Jim Chalmers is about to hand down the May budget. Before he even stands up to speak, Australia will have smashed through the $1 trillion in debt mark.
We're in debt up to our eyeballs right now.
Well, in 1969, they faked a landing on the moon.
This debt did not just happen. It has been cooking for years.
Global warming can't be real. Walt Disney's head, hey, what's the deal?
Let's be clear, when the government spends more than it earns, that gap becomes a deficit. And when you run a deficit, you borrow money. And when you borrow year after year, that becomes debt. So a blowout today is a bigger debt tomorrow. This is Finance 101.
And so it must be true, or am I going insane?
Well, it's clear Labor's pathological obsession with big spending isn't going anywhere.
It was actually bigger government spending. And this is just the first layer, because the deeper you go, the uglier it gets.
The world is just a hologram, the Titanic, an insurance scam. The face on Mars looks just like Henry Ford.
Australia is paying around $2 billion per month in interest. That could hit $3 billion per month later this decade.
The earth is flat and that is that I heard from a guy named Dave.
At the moment, we're paying about $25 billion a year in interest on the debt.
Wow.
The fastest growing line item in the budget is not NDIS, it's interest. It's growing at around 13 to 14% per annum.
A very reliable source.
This is big. This is big. This is big.
All the truth, it must be known. Please share it in a tweet or post or podcast on your phone.
Wow.
Wow, indeed, Harry. Who needs conspiracy theories when you've got everyone talking about this debt myth all the time? And I just want to clarify, I'm not disputing the number. It's quite likely that we've drifted or drifting towards that $1 trillion number. And we're not disputing that the federal government now and federal governments past have spent this money. But I think what we're disagreeing with is that we're calling it a debt. So what would be your take on it?
Yeah, we're all audio here, so you guys can't see this, but I'm actually, whilst listening to that, I was actually ripping my ears off and filling my ear holes with concrete.
Sorry to do that to you.
Yeah, it's a painful listen when we turn on the news. Mm. So what is government debt? It is simply the record, the total number of dollars the Australian government has spent into our hands, into the economy, mm-hmm. over the course of its existence. So we're probably familiar on this show about deficits, right? Mm-hmm. So what's a government deficit? Well, let's say the government spends $100 mm-hmm. and taxes 40. We call that a government deficit of 60. But what's the MMT thing? We say you're not looking at the other side of the equation there.
Mm.
Because for us, for the private sector, the non-government, that's a surplus of $60, right? So that's the key MMT thing, and that's usually the first thing we understand. And everyone understands that once you explain it to them. It's just a simple accounting fact.
Pretty logical, isn't it? When we're talking about this debt, we're only looking at one side of the transaction.
Exactly.
So if I took $10 out of my pocket and I gave it to you, well, yes, I've got minus 10, but hello, there's more to the story. You've got plus 10.
Exactly. Yes, yes, that's right. And so we're familiar with that, probably especially for listeners on this show. The deficit is the flow of that. Mm. So it's the flow of money in any given period. So if they've run a deficit, there's been a flow of income to the private sector. Mm. So what's government debt? It's simply the accumulated stock of those flows. So you want, presumably, to have more Australian dollars in your bank account tomorrow than you did today,
mm-hmm.
and next year than you did this year, and so does your mum and your dad.
I do aspire, Harry.
Yes, right. We all want that, and so does your neighbour and your local fish and chip shop owner. We in the private sector would like to have more dollars over time. Well, dollars come, Australian dollars, come from one place and one place only, and that's the federal government through the RBA. Yes, it gets a little bit more complicated because we've chosen to let banks create them when they make loans.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, those are all coming from the government's balance sheet. So what's debt? This is why Stephanie Kelton says debt is part of private sector savings.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of calling it the public debt, we could equally call it our savings.
The very same number. And of course, we're talking about the federal government here.
Yes.
And we're talking about the federal government's debt is exactly the same money that if I've got $10 in my bank account, that's part of the federal government debt.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. I could press a button right now, like Stephanie does this kind of thought experiment. I could press a button and get rid of all the government debt, and that would get rid of all the bonds and the savings that are out there held by the private sector. So not a very good idea. And once we understand this, I mean, it makes a lot more sense. Like if you look at America, they've got their debt ceiling. It's an arbitrary number where they say, we don't want the debt to go over this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, since its inception in the 30s, they've raised their debt ceiling 100 times, over 100 times, right? So if it was this scientific thing that we can't do it, and every time they've bumped up against it, mm-hmm. it's Armageddon and it's going to be hyperinflation and stuff. But of course, it never is. They just raise it.
Mm.
And why is that? Well, because like we just said, yeah, we want, generally, in a capitalist economy, we're going to tend to have a private sector that's trying to save.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to have more dollars in the system in 1980 than we did in 1970.
Mm.
And we're going to have more in 1990 than we did in 1980. And it just so happens that they accumulate as something called treasury securities or government securities in Australia.
Okay.
So you run that deficit, you've created your $60 for a private sector that's out there getting spent in someone's bank account. Mm. But the way it works is, let's say the Australian government in 1 year runs a deficit of $100 million. And let's say they don't tax any. So they just spend $100 million on they want to build a bridge. So there's a tender process and a private builder or contractor is hired to build the bridge and it comes time to pay them their $100 million. What happens? Parliament approves that $100 million in spending. The government treasury instructs their bank, the RBA, to credit the account of that contractor or builder, so they might bank with Westpac. Well, they'll say, hey, Westpac, can you please credit their account? And Westpac will put a plus $100 million on their little spreadsheet, and that bridge...
Voila!
That's right, yeah, you've created money. But you've also created... The bank sits there and goes, hey, that's great, I've created this bank money for these guys, but I need something to balance things out on my end.
Mm.
And so the RBA says, don't worry, we've got you sorted.
Mm-hmm.
Banks have an account with the RBA where they accumulate and trade something called exchange settlement balances. Or we can use the American parlance because it's easier, reserves,
mm-hmm.
right? And they're a different kind of money. They don't get lent out as money the way we think of it in the private sector. They're just a intra-bank money that's mm-hmm. used for settlement between banks themselves and between banks and the RBA.
Mm.
So the RBA says, oh, here you go, Westpac. Here's $100 million. We've credited your reserve account, $100 million. Now, that $100 million in bank money that the contractor got, that's a separate thing. Mm. This is the key point from MMT, that it's lost in all the neoclassical and the mainstream talk because they just talk about this nebulous term. They talk about money. But you got to go into the details, and that's what MMT does. So, yes, it's created that bank deposit, and that's out there now in the economy. That's money the government's created through its spending,
mm-hmm.
as we know as MMT is.
Mm.
That's out there getting spent. But Westpac still has that $100 million in reserves sitting in their account. Now, what did we just say? There's limited things a bank can do with that.
Mm-hmm.
It can't lend it out, so it cannot and does not enter the private retail banking system right. as we know it. So it can just sit there kind of gathering dust. They'll either earn zero interest on those reserves, or these days they usually pay interest on them, but it'll be the lowest interest rate you can get
mm-hmm.
in the economy. So you're a bank, you're looking for anything you can do with that money to get a higher return.
Right.
So we've legislated that the government, when it runs a deficit of $100 million, there's no need for them to do this, but we just like them to issue a government security in an equal amount. And we call that borrowing, and unfortunately we call that government debt. The Australian federal government, they say to Westpac, hey, that $100 million you've got sitting there in reserves just left over,
mm.
sort of gathering dust, how would you like to trade it for something called a government security, and you can earn a little bit more interest? If you're the bank, it's a no-brainer, right? Of course you do.
I never heard of a bank that didn't want to make more interest.
That's right, and that's what happens. So in Australia, government bond auctions are always oversubscribed.
Mm.
There's always more demand. The banks are always scrambling to get them, and why wouldn't they be? And of course, this is probably a story for another day, but as MMTers, we know that even if the banks for some reason didn't want those bonds, mm. wouldn't be a problem because then you can just get the RBA to buy them, like most of the economies in the world did over COVID. Right.
So a treasury security is a bond. It's kind of the same diff, isn't it? And mm-hmm. the way I think of it is that they get away with calling this $1 trillion a debt because of the bonds getting involved in the whole process, because for anyone else who's issuing bonds, they would be borrowing. But for the federal government that makes the currency, it's not borrowing.
Yes. Yeah, it's not borrowing in any sense that you could legitimately call it borrowing, in the sense that what did we just say in that previous example? They created the reserves themselves. Mm. They created one type of Australian dollar just out of thin air. And then they said, hey, would you like to trade that for another kind of Australian dollar called a bond? Is that borrowing? If you borrow back what you created yesterday, today, and you can create an infinite amount of both bonds and the reserves, we can hardly consider it borrowing, right? You wouldn't worry about insolvency if you had a printing press.
Yeah, and that's the whole thing about this, isn't it? Is that we don't get to see all these operations as end users of the currency. And so most people have got no idea that this is going on.
Right.
And no idea why they can get away with calling it the debt. And you just assume that it's something the government has to pay back someday, which of course it isn't. And it's funny, you know, this bonds that they're offering the banks so that the banks can earn a bit of interest on these reserves. You know, I think about it as risk-free income to the banks, so that when you hear somebody saying, as we just did, that the interest payments on the so-called debt are growing faster than the spending on the NDIS, I reckon they really should be saying, you know what, the spending on welfare for the banks is growing faster than spending on welfare for people with disability.
Yes, yeah, that's exactly right. That's the important thing to point out, like in that horrendous clip we had to listen to. Yeah, it's important to note that, yeah, there's one true thing that they did say, and that's correct, yeah. When we've got, and again, there's no need to do this, but we choose to have rules where the government has to issue debt to match its deficits, well, then it will accumulate debt because it will run deficits over time.
Exactly. Well, you know, I was apologising to your ears just before, Harry, but I probably aren't that apologetic because I am going to keep beating this dead horse. Because it's not the first time that we've had the media hysteria over this $1 trillion figure. And I did find a conversation from just prior to the 2022 federal election, and that was when Labor won government. And at that time, Peter Dutton, who was the Defence Minister, and Richard Marles, who was Labor's Deputy Leader of the Opposition, they were discussing what were the key issues, apparently, facing voters. And they were discussing that with Alison Langdon of Nine News Australia.
Defence Minister Peter Dutton, who joins us from Brendale in Queensland, and Opposition Leader Richard Marles, who's here in the studio. Good morning to both of you.
Morning, Ali.
Richard, you do seem okay with a whole lot of debt.
Let's be clear. This is the government which doubled the debt before the pandemic started. This is the government which is first one to go to an election with $1 trillion of debt.
Well, I mean, we could have taken a decision not to roll out JobKeeper, but 700,000 or 800,000 Australians would have lost their jobs. Literally tens or hundreds of thousands of businesses would have gone to the wall. So, yes, we've built up debt over the last couple of years of the pandemic, but this is the greatest shock to our economy since the Great Depression. And the debt that we've incurred has been to support families, small businesses, to keep people in employment. The debt that Labor's talking about, it never has an end to it because they can't manage money.
And I don't think we've seen an appetite from either side of politics to pay down that debt.
I mean, Labor always talks about good economic management when they're in opposition, but when they get in, they always drive up debt, and it means higher taxes. Massive more debt means more inflation, higher interest rates under Labor, and that's not something our country needs at the moment. There's going to be difficult times ahead, and we need to have a government that can deal with the issues. They're talking about debt upon debt upon debt.
$1 trillion.
$1 trillion. $1 trillion. $1 trillion.
Guys, I'm not sure if you can hear that. You probably can't. It's the sound of me peeling the skin off my face. Yeah, can't be having to listen to Peter Dutton on a Friday.
It's pretty
night.
Rough, isn't it, to do that to people? I had to play that because we do like to be fair and balanced on Radio MMT. So I did want to point out that both sides of the aisle in politics will wield that $1 trillion debt stick, even though, of course, we're saying it's not really a debt and it's money that often the government does need to spend. And speaking about irrelevant numbers, so we've got that $1 trillion debt, which is a sort of irrelevant number when it comes to the health of the economy. So I did find a couple of other numbers. So if we are looking at Australia's debt, so-called, they measure it as a percent of GDP. So lately Australia's debt's been around 37%. And you can compare that to the United States. Theirs is at around 124%. And then there's Japan leading the pack with a debt ratio of 216%. Go Japan.
It's absurd. Yeah, the Japan thing's a good one to mention. Like, it's been, I think, 250% before.
Okay.
And, of course, it's just a glaring contradiction of mainstream economics, right? Because that predicts that if you get to that level of debt, they've been predicting for like years and years and years that Japan's going to implode. It's going to have hyperinflation. And
people have lost money betting on it.
They have, yeah. They call it the widowmaker's trade because they keep trying to short Japanese government bonds because their theory says, oh, they should implode.
Mm.
Coming back to Australia, you can go back to 2019 and hear Josh Frydenberg saying the exact same thing right on the eve, the precipice of the COVID thing. December 2019, he's on the radio saying, We've got no money. We've got no. We need to get
the
debt down and all this stuff.
We're going to have to cut social security.
Yeah, right. And then about 3 months later, the government was spending spend. Yeah,
like a drunken sailor.
Exactly, huge amounts, massive, like the biggest it's probably ever has, probably since wartime. And yeah, I mean, that's really interesting because in 2019, at that time of him saying that. Like in the government's like account thing ledger that it keeps at the central bank, just the kind of scoreboard on a football game. It's called the official public account, the OPA.
Mm-hmm.
I think they had around $30 billion or something in there at the time, right? Their supposed money that's apparently scarce to them, even though they create it every time they spend. And to be clear, we shouldn't have to look for a smoking gun, right? Because the thing with MMT is it's a logical point, first of all. The dollars only come from one place, so the spending has to come first. We shouldn't have to look for a smoking gun and things like that, but these contradictions are everywhere. So there's only $30 billion in the OPA. The amount of currency and reserves in the system at the time, I think, were just over $100 billion or something. And then suddenly, in a heartbeat, the government's spending like multiples of that.
Yeah. That was the JobKeeper.
Yeah.
So they took on a big chunk of the nation's payroll, didn't they?
Right, exactly. Like, did the tax man come knocking on your door in January 2020 and say, oh my God, the government needs a couple of hundred billion? No, they didn't.
Hi, I'm Kim Salmon. I'd like to have a quick word about public radio, particularly 3CR. The thing about public radio is that it's more open than the more formatted types of radio to what's going on around it. So when you listen to it, you're more likely to hear a reflection of real life. And 3CR being in the heart of Smith Street, Collingwood, is a particularly good example of what I'm talking about. If you'd like to subscribe, the number is 94198377.
You've been listening.
You mentioned that the tax man comes knocking at your door. That reminded me that I would like to acknowledge that debt is a scary word. And in fact, for anyone who doesn't issue the currency, which would be you and me, Harry, and
yes.
Most people I know, if you get into debt that looks unpayable, it is really a terrible situation to be in. And, you know, you just have to look at experiences throughout history where you've got the so-called third world debt. So nations can get into debt. Say the debt is denominated in US dollars and you're a South American nation. Well, you don't create those dollars. So being in that kind of debt is pretty horrible. And then, you know, you've got moments in history where you've had debt prisons. People would get thrown into prison for debt. Or you had indentured servitude, so people would get sent halfway around the world to work like slaves to pay off their so-called debts. So debt is a real experience, I think, in the psyche. This is why you can scare people with it.
Oh, yeah. It's biblical. I mean, it's in the name too, bond. That goes back to, like, ancient times when if you couldn't pay your creditors, your children and your loved ones would get taken as a bond servant.
Horrendous.
Yeah, so...
And we even can look closer to home and more recently at robo-debt. So, of course, there you could see how debt is so psychologically painful that people actually killed themselves when they thought those debts were real. And, of course, no one's been held accountable for that one. But I think it was only the MMTers who were pointing out at that time that that whole sorry saga with robo-debt, that only got set in motion under the cover of this story that the Australian federal government's in debt and it needs to somehow find a way to get the money back.
Yeah. It's important to keep in mind, like, austerity kills people. And so that's why it's so important to educate people about this. Mm. I mean, let's go to a real-world example. Early 2000s, Costello was the treasurer who was... He was celebrated for delivering, I think, 11 fiscal surpluses in a row to reduce the debt, right? Like, it's not like there haven't been natural experiments to see what happens when we do this stuff.
Best treasurer ever.
Yeah, we're supposed to celebrate that, which we already know that's silly, because if you're celebrating the government running a surplus, what are you celebrating? Them sucking more money out of the system, deleting more money through taxes than they're giving you through spending. So it's silly. It's celebrating getting robbed. But the irony goes deeper than that, right? So what was the consequence of Costello running these surpluses? You deprive the private sector, the non-government sector, of the net financial assets, of the dollars that it needs to save and to maintain its current spending. And yet we avoid a recession. Yes, the foreign sector plays a role here in mining and stuff, but that's another story for another day. What's really happening there is in the early 2000s, the government's sucking all this money out of the system. It's just an accounting fact that to maintain your household's living standards and your current spending, what do? You go into private debt.
Mm.
So right then when we can see them all cheering that public debt's going down, yes, the people who can't run out of money aren't in debt anymore. We're supposed to celebrate that. But what was happening then? Australia's private debt was skyrocketing. They were deregulating this stuff. Australians were being encouraged to spend. People ran up their credit card debts. They took on big fat mortgages, creating a housing bubble.
Mm.
And now we're living the consequences of that. It's tearing at the social fabric. Fascists are tricking the gullible amongst us into blaming immigrants. You know, neo-Nazism is rearing its ugly head.
Hmm.
Those are the consequences of reducing the national debt. So thanks, Costello.
Well, on that note, let's take a break and we will be back with our conversation with Harry and we might get on to degrowth.
Radio MMT.
The facts about economics.
Radio MMT.
With Anne and Kev, bringing you fair and balanced reporting.
They are bastards, utter and complete bastards, Anne.
That's right. We're really digging into this bastardry.
It's a smokescreen for corporations to increase their profit margin.
All these big lies.
Corporate profit and greed.
They're considering it in their evil plans.
He's the archetype megalomaniac neoliberal.
The government pretending to be there for the people.
The neoliberal ethos of squeezing workers.
This power struggle is continuously playing out under our very noses.
So it's simplistic and it's inaccurate.
What kind of an economic recovery strategy is that?
Do you reckon
that?
It's more effective to say it's spurious to say the least, or it's bullshit?
Radio MMT.
The second and fourth Friday of each month.
Between 5:30 and 6:30 p.m.
Here on 3CR Community Radio.
You boost productivity, you boost national economic growth. Our plan is a growth agenda.
We can make sure the economy grows very strongly so that the pie is bigger and so there'll be more funding for everything. That's the best option.
Well, obviously, it's about growing the economy.
Grow the economy, grow the economy.
Grow the economy. So our goal is to grow the economy, an economy that is expected to grow by 4.25% this year and 3.5% next year.
Yes, you are back with Radio MMT. I'm Anne, your host, in conversation with Harry Rosson, and I'm doing a real number on you today, Harry.
Yep, that was a certified banger from Anne.
Well, we had a bit of a boogie around the studio here to the growth agenda. So we're going to talk growth, degrowth, and I was reading a Substack article by economic anthropologist Jason Hickel, and he was talking about a survey where they presented 5,000 people with these standalone words, so that means that they didn't have a definition, so they just gave them the word and said, what do you think? And so they gave them well-being economy, and that was supported or seen favourably by up to 81% of these 5,000 people. They gave them the word eco-socialism, That was seen favourably by about 58%. And then they gave them the word degrowth, and that was seen favourably by about 26%. So Hickel pointed out that the word degrowth, it might not be as popular as words like a well-being economy. And he said maybe it's not so useful as what he called a public-facing political slogan, unless, Harry, you have the capacity to educate people about what the term degrowth means and what, you know, a degrowth transition would entail. So please, Harry, do educate us.
Okay, yeah, I did see that study. And yeah, that's an important caveat. So people don't like the term degrowth. That shouldn't surprise us. They prefer like well-being economy or something. But when people were presented it alongside a brief kind of synopsis of, hey, this is what degrowth is, those differences largely disappear. When paired with the full proposal, they did the study both in the UK and the US, and it got around 80% support when paired with the synopsis. So those were kind of the two insights I took from it. Yep, people don't like degrowth as a word when it's sprung on them, but when it's explained to them, they're like, okay.
So give us, dear listener, give us your next 5 minutes so we can convince you.
Right, yeah. So first of all, what's the problem? Listeners probably are already familiar. Most people are familiar. You know, the ecological crisis is escalating. We're threatened with the possible collapse of industrialized civilization, possibly this century. Seven of the nine planetary boundaries that scientists identify as critical to maintaining the stability of the Earth system that we all depend on, we're overshooting seven of those nine things. Climate change is just one of those, it's worth noting. There's biogeochemical flows, so that's like mass extinction. So yes, there's fossil fuels, but it's also clear-cutting the Amazon so that, you know, we can have cheap beef at a trillion McDonald's stores around the world, destroying species that are key to the ecosystem, industrialized agriculture, the runoff it's causing, ocean die-offs. I don't want to depress everyone. But yeah, that's the bad news, which I probably don't need to beat a dead horse about. It's pretty grim. The other thing is, and what's shocking, why are we there? What's driving the ecological crisis? And, you know, the easy answer that people go to is fossil fuels. And yes, as we just said, that's part of the problem, but it's a deeper problem than that. It's the ever-increasing physical size of our economy, right? Because if you study mainstream economics, they don't even really recognize this. They see the economy as this separate, distinct kind of thing that exists outside of the environment and even the way we talk about the environment, right? You're interested in the environment. What a niche thing. It's like, yeah, that thing that sustains us and without it, we'll all die. I do enjoy drinking fresh water and breathing.
It's very niche.
Yeah, I like air and oxygen. Yeah, so that's where we come from in degrowth is ecological economics, which takes a completely different ontology, which when I explain it to people, I say it's how a sane person who hasn't been brainwashed by economics would just think economics works, which is that you say, right, we've got this economy that's embedded in a finite natural world where we take raw materials, finite, limited materials, and we use technology and labor and we turn them into stuff that we need. And that's not a bad thing. We do need stuff, but there are limits because it's a finite Earth. We're lucky enough to have a sun powering those biogeochemical flows, which make the Earth into a kind of battery that can recycle a bunch of that stuff. But there's limits to the rate at which it can do that. We're overshooting those limits. So what's the problem with growth? Well, what is growth? We hear it all the time, right? Yes. It sounds good. And you hear it from all sides of the political spectrum. People love it. But what is it really? They're talking about GDP growth. Well, what's GDP? GDP is a measure of all the stuff we've produced and sold in a period, say in a year. So it's stuff. So when they say we want to grow GDP, they're saying we want to produce more stuff. Just think about that for a second. That's insane. That's not very strategic, is it? You don't go to a restaurant and you don't even look at the menu. You just say, I'll have heaps. What do you want? Heaps,
just
more.
Just lots of it.
Yeah, that's like it's the ideology of a cancer cell.
Yeah. And that's the ideology that our politicians subscribe to.
Right. And then it's with capitalism as well. It's built into that, right? So how does that work? Well, you might not like the idea of that, but you still need access to need satisfiers. You need access to healthcare, education, and in a capitalist system, you have to go and work to produce stuff you don't need to afford the stuff you really do need.
Oh, yeah.
So it's like, yeah, you can have, you know, a place to live and some fresh fruit and go to the theatre or something, but sorry, you need to log 12 hours at the plastic bag burning factory first. So the guy selling plastic bags to be burnt can. So it's an insane system, a top-heavy system. So what's degrowth? Well, degrowth's a rationalisation of the economy. And let's be honest, that thing of just growing every and any sector more and more exponentially, it's a mathematical impossibility. Like anyone except for economists, especially physicists, will tell you it violates the laws of thermodynamics, right? If we grow the physical economy at 3% per year, that's a double in time of 26 years, roughly. That means that in, say, 2052, if we're saying, yeah, 3% growth, let's have that, we're talking about doubling the physical size of the economy.
Aren't we already at more than a planet?
Right. Globally, we're at like 1.7 planets worth of biocapacity. So we're using too much. And that's mostly the global north, the 20% of the population or something. It's countries like ours, it's probably more like we're using four or five planets.
So we'd be at 3.4 in 20-odd years.
Yes, yeah. And what's the other problem? With all this production, all this excess, this abundance, we produce so much stuff. Yes. We've had plenty of growth. We've
been having growth. Mountains of fast fashion, I've seen.
Right, we produce heaps of stuff. And yet the many go without, right? Like, what an absurd system. Like, we have 80 people or something have more than half the world's population. Billions live in poverty, don't have access to basic healthcare. Over 3 million Australians live in poverty. We have hundreds of thousands of homeless. So people know this and it's an absurd system. But it's hard for us to pin down what's actually happening. It's easy to look at that and say, oh, we're damned if we do, we're damned if we don't. We got to choose between providing for everyone or destroying the planet.
Yeah.
Right? And that's why degrowth is so powerful, because it's saying, wait, hang on a second. Aren't we being a bit silly? Because we're producing a whole lot of stuff we don't need. We're producing super yachts for the Epstein class, you know, so they can buy their islands and have their private jets, right? That's stuff we don't need.
Pulling down bits of the White House and rebuilding it.
Right, exactly. We're doing crazy stuff, and we're not providing the basics. So that's the other thing. If you go out and hear straw man in the conservative media, they'll say degrowth, it's just collapse and recession. But degrowth's not shrinking everything. It's growing the important stuff still. Let's have more healthcare, more education.
More public housing.
Public housing, quality public housing. And let's have less private jets and super yachts and billionaire pedophiles bombing people.
Ballrooms at the top of skyscrapers, yes, and bombing people.
Right, exactly. So it's really a rationalisation of the economic system. It's getting away from this blame the victim where we say use your paper straws and stuff and saying, hang on, the thing that's causing this is on the production side. We're producing a whole lot of crap so that people who own stuff can own more stuff so that billionaires can get richer, which people realize, but I don't think we've really put two and two together and said, hey, we can have one without the other. We can say, all right, let's put a cap on resource use. Let's slow down. And so that's what degrowth is. If you want the kind of tagline, just paraphrasing here from one of the key researchers, Timothy Parikh, it's a planned downscaling of production and consumption in a democratic way that reduces the ecological footprint while providing for everyone's needs. And what does that look like in the day-to-day? Well, if you want the kind of laundry list of degrowth policies, that looks like work time reduction. So let's reduce the working week to 3 days a week.
Woohoo! I keep hearing 4 days and you've gone down
to
three.
Let's go three. And like maximum income, so capping income, but also capping resource use. Mm-hmm. So you can have like a sliding scale. You might get every household in Australia gets a quota of energy for free, but then it becomes prohibitively expensive after that. You can do the same thing with giving everyone a kind of stipend of fresh, locally produced produce that publicly paid workers might tend to public gardens. You can think of this stuff. And also you got to have a transition at some point, right, as well. Yes, let's transition to 100% renewables, but trying to do that in the growth mindset whilst also growing, it's like Jason Hickel says, it's like trying to walk up a down escalator. I mean, let's say I switch a button right now and I can transition us to 100% renewables, everything, the whole economy. Well, what did we just say? If we're growing at 3% per year, well, it's like, that means nothing. In 2052, you've got to be prepared to do double that. You've got to have double the lithium mines, you know, double the amount of child slaves in the Congo mining your rare earth minerals for double the amount of iPhone so you can have your iPhone 47.
So it's not just your energy, it's all your other physical materials as well.
Yeah, by stopping the growth fetish, we make the job of achieving 1.5 degrees and actually having a sustainable economy actually something we can do. And this isn't just talk, right? Like, this is empirically...
We've gotten to the good news, I can tell.
Yeah, right. So now we get into the good news because this is empirically validated as well. So researchers have found that we can provide decent living standards for a global population of 8.5 billion in 2050. Decent living standards, the material basis for decent living standards, at a fraction of our current energy and resource use.
Wow.
We could provide it twice over to account for rounding error, and still be at about half of our current resource and energy use.
What do we mean by a decent standard of living?
Right, so that's the other thing. So people hear this and they go, oh, what do you mean? Like, everyone gets like a government-issued potato sack.
And a potato.
Right. Maybe we can drop the reference to the paper because they have a real great, awesome, punchy quote in that when they say, oh, people have said that it's going to be a return to living in caves. And they say, well, it's a pretty sweet cave because it accounts for everyone to have a laptop, a phone.
Oh, nice.
And it accounts for, you know, healthcare and the floor space for amount of hospitals per person, transport, heating and cooling adjusted for where in the world you live.
My cave is quite cozy.
It's a cozy cave, and it's got room to spare as well. We sometimes want some creature comforts and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not talking about this like miserable system. And you got to remember as well, like in that world, what did we just say? It's a 3-day work week. You're spending more time with your family and stuff, which when they've trialed this, people's mental health's gotten better, their relationships get better. So you've got 4 days to just like hang out, cook home-cooked meals. Yes, stuff might get a little bit more expensive, but what have you got? You've got universal public services. You've got free healthcare, free education, childcare, aged care, you know, food to an extent and energy, like we just said, on a sliding scale. So what have you done here? You've decommodified the access to need satisfiers. So people don't need to go and earn an income producing some crap they don't need to afford the stuff they do. You cut out the middleman and you just rationalize the economic system and say, hey, we're in a crisis. We've got a shortage of planetary resources. Let's make sure everyone has healthcare. Everyone has quality housing. Everyone has education.
So that's a key thing, isn't it? The universal basic services
along with... It's crucial.
Telling the billionaires that they really shouldn't have 5 aeroplanes.
Right, because if you look at the first few things on that list, you'll go, reducing working time, oh my God, what's going to happen to my income? I've got kids to feed. I've got rent to pay. But this is the genius of the universal public services. You decommodify it and you just provide it directly.
Mm.
Now, the next thing you say is, oh my God, who's going to pay for that? That sounds expensive. That's where you tie it back into the MMT. That's why MMT is so important. Because there's one entity in the country. You can't go and just provide free healthcare because you're a nice person if you're a capitalist or something.
Mm-hmm.
Your business will go under because you're not the currency issuer. There's one entity that can do that, and that's the Australian federal government. Once we understand that as voters, it massively expands the horizons of what we expect for them and what we can demand, because it makes us see that the Australian dollar is actually a public utility. It's our collective resource. It's a tool for organising resources. It's not a thing the government needs to get from rich people.
Mm.
So what's the takeaway? Money doesn't grow on rich people. It comes from the government. So money's not the problem. So that solves a big part. We've got problems. We don't need to add imaginary problems about the government running out of money. So if people can take that away, we'll be happy days.
I wish our politicians would listen to more people like you, and we'll have to get you back to Radio MMT. But thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we'll see you another time. You've been listening to Radio MMT with Anne and Kev.
We'd love your feedback. Email us on radiommt@gmail.com or search Radio MMT on social media.
Listen to this show anytime, wherever you get your podcasts, or on 3cr.org.au/radio MMT.
Support this show and the station by subscribing to 3cr.org.au and mention Radio MMT.
We thank all our guests
And we thank economist Professor Bill Mitchell and his MMTED.org, educating masses on modern monetary theory.
And thank you to our listening listeners for listening. And I thank you, Kevin.
And I thank you, Anne. So what's planned for next week?
Kevin, there is still so much to talk about. We've got to expose all this rotten economics.
Well, that's good, and I get it. Do you reckon we could use a bit more music?
Well, I made a list of all these terrible economic theories. Like, I've heard of the theory of comparative advantage, or the quantity theory of money, or the loanable funds theory.
Have you heard of a band called Single Gun Theory? Like, they're a really good band. I'm sure there's a whole range of, like, macroeconomic music that I could bring into the show.
Yeah, but we really need to do marginal productivity theory, not to mention the natural rate of unemployment and the money multiplier.
You've got a pretty good singing voice. I play bass. Bill, he plays guitar. I reckon we could form a macroeconomic band. Like, we could deliver this whole message by music.
Well, we could call the band the Permanent Income Hypothesis, or the Ricardian Equivalence, or Rational Expectations.
I think we're onto something here. We're trying to make macroeconomics more interesting to the masses. We're going to, like, form this band and sing it to them. And we're going to bring the economists in. We're going to get musical.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.